And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and my guest this week is Carrie Beberis, who is the author of a 7-book series of mystery novels starring Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, the newest of which is The Suspicion at Sanditon, set in the world of Sanditon, the last and unfinished novel Austen had worked on just prior to her death. Now, Carrie, how did you come up with the idea of giving Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy lives outside of their original novel?
Well, I was rereading Pride and Prejudice for, I don't know, the nth time, and got to the end of it where Mr. Wickham elopes with Lizzie's sister, and Darcy is instrumental in helping find the couple and getting Wickham to do the right thing and marry Lydia. Elizabeth is a student of character in the novel, and, you know, she looks at people closely and has insights into their personalities, whereas Darcy is a man of the world who can go out and get things done, and that's why he's able to find this eloped couple in all of London. And I got to the end of it, and I thought, you know, if they could accomplish that before they got together as a couple, what could they do after? And I had been writing fantasy at the time and thinking of switching to the mystery genre for a number of reasons. And it was just the timing of those two things. My interest in moving into a different genre, mystery in particular, and just happening to be rereading one of my favorite novels of all time. And that's how the idea came to me.
It was one of the reasons you want to move out of fantasy, because it's so tough to come up with names.
Well, no, you just take a bunch of consonants and throw them all together and toss in a vowel here or there. Actually, it was the battle scenes that I found the most difficult to write. And I was having a conversation with a colleague of mine who also writes fantasy. We were talking about writer's block and what we do to kind of overcome that when it pops up. And he said, oh, when I get writer's block, I write battle scenes because it's action on the page, it gets things moving, it gets me over that hump, and then I can move on, you know, to the rest of the stuff. And I just looked at him and I said, really? When I get stuck, I write dialogue. And I realized that that was the conflict that I was more interested in exploring. And in a mystery, that's very often the main source of the conflict. You've got one character who's got a secret to hide and another character who's trying to find it out and other characters who have their secrets as well that they want to hang on to. That just really intrigued me. And I read eclectically anyway. So, you know, I thought, you know, I think I want to try to expand my horizons there. The first two books of the series did have some fantasy elements in them, so it was sort of a transitional thing for me. The later books have drifted away from that and become a little more straight historical fiction, although
there's a little supernatural
there
action.
There is, yes, a little bit in this seventh one.
It's appropriate for the time. I mean, all throughout the 19th century, spiritualism and supernatural concerns and ghosts and mediums were a big deal.
Absolutely. And Austen, when she first started writing, the first novel that she sold, although it ended up being the last one published, was Northanger Abbey, which was a parody of the Gothic novels of her time. And so, you know, incorporating those elements into my books, I didn't feel was too far removed from something that she might have appreciated. You know, I drew the line at zombies, didn't go over there, but that certainly didn't prevent other people from taking it that next step.
Suspicion at Sanditon has a lot of Gothic because you have an old house, you have a dark and stormy night, and they're by the coast, some supernatural goings on, so it seems very Gothic in its way.
Oh, absolutely, and I did that on purpose. The Suspicion at Sanditon is based on an unfinished manuscript that Austen left behind when she died. And when I read it, what struck me about it is that it calls to mind the character and tone of her juvenilia, the things that she was writing as a young woman, Northanger Abbey, those earlier works. And it's a very humorous manuscript. The characters are in some cases just over the top, really outrageous. And I thought it would be fun to play with that, you know, since at the end of her life, she had seemed to, you know, go back to that. To do that in my own book, to play with those Gothic elements, to exactly, you know, have the characters trapped in a mansion on a dark and stormy night with guests disappearing one by one.
Do you think her, like, kind of sense of mortality and maybe in the back of her head she could feel that maybe her life was coming to an end, that's why she wanted to revisit some of those things?
I really think that might be so. And in a way, it's a little surprising because she had just finished writing Persuasion, which I always feel a more autumnal tone to it. It's, you know, the hero and heroine of that book are older. They fell in love years ago, separated by other people, and then find their way back to each other, as opposed to Pride and Prejudice, which is a story of, you know, young love, and Austen herself had called it, you know, light and bright and sparkling. And so having finished Persuasion and taking up, you know, her pen again to write a new work, also her being in poor health at the time and being very conscious of that and not knowing what was wrong with her, because in the 19th century, you know, they didn't know that she had what we now believe was Addison's disease. You know, for her to be writing something so comic and so light compared to the work she had just finished, you know, really struck me that, yeah, you know, maybe this was her escape from the, you know, the reality that, that she was living in terms of this, you know, worry about her health.
But she is known for her wit.
Absolutely.
And I have to say, your wit in the book, for some reason, the line that got me the most, they had been dispatched by Lady Denham, who's the owner of Sanditon House, to go look at the portrait gallery upstairs. And it says, everyone's interest in portraiture sated for the present. And I just laughed out loud.
Well, thank you. I made a conscious decision when I started the series that I was not going to try to imitate Austen's style, you know, to as other sequelists have done. There's a reason we're still reading her 200 years after her death, and it's because nobody can capture exactly that voice of hers. It's unique, and it always will be. But I wanted to capture the spirit of it, write in a style that was compatible with hers. I myself have a more formal writing voice. I would have a difficult time writing contemporary fiction, I think, compared to what I do write. And so I decided that I would rather sing an alto that harmonized with what Austen does rather than be the soprano that almost hits the high note and doesn't quite, and that dissonance is more uncomfortable than...
Kind of like an uncanny valley thing.
Exactly.
With Sanditon being an unfinished work, did you feel more freedom with that, or did you feel a little scared that you didn't quite have the bones you would have with the other novels?
A little bit of both, because the characters from the other novels, you know, they have been tested. You know, part of what develops character is how those people respond to the conflicts and the events of the stories in which they appear. And so the unfinished manuscript is 11 and a half chapters, about 24,000 words, which is about a third of one of her finished books. And being a 19th century novel, it starts with a lot of exposition, and we have a lot of introduction of characters and a lot of backstory, but it's just when Sidney Parker, who I presume Austen had in mind as the romantic hero, just when he gets to town and the reader senses that things are going to start moving now, that's when it ends. And so these characters were sort of left in a state of suspended animation, and you never get to see what was going to test them and how they would respond to it. So there was that freedom there for me to develop those characters a little more and put them in a different story. The story I wrote is obviously not the story Austen would have written. We will never know what that story was. But I can fairly confidently say it was not going to be a Mr. and Mrs. Darcy mystery. I don't think she was going to bring Elizabeth and Darcy into Sanditon to solve people's problems there. But it's the story that I could tell. I'm, you know, humbly pleased to have been able to finally give those characters a story and an ending and a tale of their own.
Now, a handful of other writers have attempted finishing Sanditon.
Yes.
Have you read any of those?
Years ago. I've read the one that's called Sanditon by Jane Austen and Another Lady.
Oh, which recently went back in print.
Yes. And I read that back when I was in college. I intentionally did not go out and read all the other authors' completions because I didn't want that to interfere with my own creative process. Mm-hmm. What I did do, I reread Sanditon in Jane Austen's own handwriting. The manuscript itself is available in digital form online. So I went and not only read it, but made my own transcription of it because I wanted to experience it as a fellow practitioner of the craft. Other people have done transcriptions. There are published versions of Sanditon that aren't completions, that are just, you know, her words. But the people who did those transcriptions came at it from a more scholarly perspective. And I know that whenever I read a novel, I read it differently than I did, you know, when I was 10. You know, one half of my brain is always looking at the structure and, you know, how the author introduced a character or, you know, planted a clue or developed tension. I just can't help it. I imagine it's the same thing that architects go through when they walk into a building or something. You just can't help noticing those things. Occasionally, I will read a book by another author where I'm not conscious of that, where I'm just so deeply engrossed in the story that it is like reading, you know, when I was a teenager again. And that's a magical thing when an author can do that for me and, you know, make me just forget that I'm a writer too until I get to the end and say, wow, I really admire that. It's magic.
I've had some people ask me, you know, is it really tough for you to read a bad book? And I go, no, it's great for the show because there are so many questions I have on why did you do this?
Oh, I bet.
You can see the kind of the nuts and bolts of the mechanics there, and there's lots of questions to ask. In a good book, you just kind of get swept up and you go, oh, man, I don't know even where to start on this
book.
Absolutely,
yes. You know, then you have to go back and say, okay, let's find out how they did this.
You mentioned that in the original manuscript that all these characters were kind of just at the point of getting going. And we have the characters in The Suspicion at Sanditon sitting around waiting because they're at a dinner party at Lady Denham's home at Sanditon House. And she's late for her own party.
Yes. They're all wondering what's going on. And these characters, they all have a reason for being very interested in Lady Denham's fortune and what's going to happen to it after she dies. She is twice widowed. Her first husband was elderly when she married him, and she was a young woman. So when he died and left her everything, he had some relatives who had some opinions about that were not very favorable toward her. So there's some tension there. And when she remarried, she married a neighboring baronet whose estate was impoverished. He was hoping that in marrying her, he'd get a cash infusion into the estate and get that back on its feet. But she kept everything for herself. So she got a title out of it, and he didn't get anything much of it either. So he has since died. His nephew has inherited the baronetcy, but doesn't have the money to really do much with it. So he's got an interest in what Lady Denham's will might say. There's also a family, the Parker family. There are five siblings. One of them is, the oldest is Thomas Parker, who, along with Lady Denham, is developing Sanditon, the village of Sanditon, into what he hopes will be an up-and-coming seaside resort. Not quite on the scale of Bath or Brighton, but a place that, you know, attracts respectable families.
More of a high-end.
Exactly. Exactly. But he is a little more adventurous in what he wants to invest in than Lady Denham is. And a source of frustration for him is that he has all these projects and he has trouble persuading her toward doing all of them. And I think part of that is the fact that she's 70 years old and probably conscious of the fact that she might not live long enough to see the return on some of these things.
Also, she's wealthy and she's
exactly.
That way for a reason. And
exactly.
It's not about throwing money around.
Yes, exactly. She's very thrifty and economical and, you know, very careful with her money. So he's got an interest. His sisters are not only outrageous hypochondriacs who are into quack medicine and all sorts of crazy, you know, self-doctoring and home remedies, but they're also very into charitable projects. So in one of them in particular, Diana is always wanting Lady Denham to donate to this or that cause. And then finally, there is a shirt tail relation of Lady Denham's, a distant cousin, who's a young woman who's orphaned and she's taken in as her ward. But it's sort of an informal arrangement. And so the woman's name is Clara. She's, you know, never quite sure how long this is going to last or, you know, as soon as Lady Denham wearies of her, she'll be out the door. So, you know, everybody's just kind of speculating about, you know, what that will might say. And to collect them all in this mansion on a dark and stormy night and have Lady Denham suddenly disappear and all of these people with an interest in her money, if not in her actual well-being, the comments start to fly and Mr. and Mrs. Darcy, as two of the more objective guests there, have to sort of step in to make sure that the investigation proceeds in a reasonable manner. And then unfortunately, the other guests start to disappear one by one, and that creates even more questions about what's going on.
Well, let's not forget Charlotte Haywood either.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Wasn't she the main character of the original?
Yes, exactly. Yes, the original Sanditon was Charlotte's story, which presented some challenges to me, because to have started that work, you know, entirely in Charlotte's point of view, I had originally thought of doing a completion, you know, as other people had done, taking Austen's original manuscript and picking up the sentence after she left off and finishing it as a Mr. and Mrs. Darcy mystery. But when I tried that, it was very difficult to have, you know, been in Charlotte's point of view for a third of the book, and then all of a sudden have the Darcys come in, because Charlotte was the heroine, but in a Mr. and Mrs. Darcy mystery, you're kind of expecting that Mr. and Mrs. Darcy are going to be on center stage. So that was part of the reason that I changed my mind and scrapped that draft and wrote it instead as the other Mr. and Mrs. Darcy mysteries, where they were simply based on the characters and circumstances and loose ends left behind in Austen's other novels.
And Elizabeth is friends with Charlotte, so that's their entree into this.
Exactly, exactly. Each book in the series introduces the Darcys to characters from a different Austen novel.
They do a lot of traveling.
But it's always a challenge to have the Darcys encounter them in a believable way. I mean, you know, Mr. Darcy can only have so many college buddies.
How is Pemberley surviving without them?
He's got a very good steward there. So in looking for ways to bring in the Darcys, I realized that at the end of the intrigue at Highbury, I had settled Colonel Fitzwilliam, Darcy's cousin, and Colonel Fitzwilliam's wife, who was also Darcy's cousin, Anne de Burgh, in the same county where Sanditon happened to take place. And so the Fitzwilliams know the Haywoods, and through them, Mr. and Mrs. Darcy have met Charlotte, know Charlotte. And so when the Darcys decide to go to Sanditon, they are kind of looking out for Charlotte, because this is her great adventure. In the original Sanditon, Charlotte had met Mr. Parker through an accident, and her parents became very good friends with the Parkers. And so when the Parkers invited Charlotte to come to Sanditon, they thought that was a good opportunity for her to get out in the world a little bit. And so this is, you know, her first entrance into a world outside of the more circumscribed household and family life that she's used to.
Sanditon is close to Hastings, and of course, 1066, and you know, we think of Guillaume de Batard, and Lady Denham is having nothing with any French.
Yes, yes.
At all. No to cafes, no to any other French-themed things in town.
Yes. Well, it does take place, you know, shortly after the Napoleonic Wars have ended. So, you know, there's kind of anti-French sentiment still around in England in general. But yes, you know, Lady Denham, she had a fortune of her own, a dowry of her own as a young woman, but she didn't have a great deal of education to go with it. And so she's a woman who isn't so much into French culture and things of that nature. You know, she wants things to be, you know, English. Even says, well, you know, maybe we'll let some Irish people come visit, you know, at the absolute most, but we don't want any of those French people coming over.
And you can kind of see kind of like parallels to contemporary society with a lot of anti-immigrant notions in Britain right now. Hypochondria of the sisters with the intolerances and homeopathic.
Yes.
Yes. Kind of like with homeopathic potions and such. And it seems that those are just common themes that go throughout time.
They do. Absolutely they do. You know, they are crusading for different causes. You see that now.
Charity muggers, chuggers, as they call them.
Yes, exactly.
There.
Exactly. And yeah, the homeopathic medicine, the, you know, alternative medicine, people giving up on traditional medicine. And that's exactly what they've done. So they do try some pretty outrageous things.
And even ridiculous exercise equipment.
Yes.
With a chamber horse.
Yes. And that was a lot of fun to research. When I first read Sanditon back in graduate school, I was reading an edition where even the person who did the footnote said, we think this is some kind of, you know, Regency era exercise equipment, but they really didn't say much about it. But now with the internet making research so much easier for so many people, I was like, you know what? And me being a mystery writer and hating having unanswered questions, I was like, I need to find out more about what this chamber horse thing is that the late Mr. Hollis, you know, as an elderly man was, you know, using. you know, what did it look like? What, you know, how did it work? With the help of a wonderful librarian at my local library who was able to get me some really great resources through interlibrary loan, I was able to track down, first of all, an article on decorating from like the 1950s that mentioned something about it. And there was an illustration in there from Sheridan's Furniture and Cabinet Making Guide, which was a series of volumes with instructions of how to build certain kinds of furniture, 18th century furniture. And the chamber horse, you know, not only was there a picture of the chamber horse, but a complete description of how to build it, what size it was, you know, what pieces you needed. And it turns out it's kind of looks like an ottoman up on higher legs, and it's an upholstered seat that has layers of springs in between, and you would sit on it and bounce on it. And again, you were talking about comparisons to modern life. You would bounce on it the way that people now use like stability balls in, you know, Pilates class or whatever, you know. And they would do that in inclement weather. You know, they didn't have treadmills. They had, you know, chamber horses. But just the image of this, you know, elderly man bouncing on this thing, you know, in his chamber, I thought was just so comic that I had to use this somehow. And so it is worked into the plot and had to find a place.
And the late Mr. Hollis was Archibald Hollis.
Yes.
But it's his nephew, Josiah Hollis, who has come to the party. And if there's anyone that's set up as a crank, it is Josiah Hollis.
Yes. Well, I needed someone to represent the relations who were so unhappy with the disposition of Archibald's estate. And also, as a writer, I needed a character who had some memory of these events that took place so long ago, because they, you know, were woven into the plot of the mystery. And so rather than, you know, just having a narrative exposition or some other means of introducing that, to have a character who had witnessed some of these things, you know, could talk about them, was necessary. But he also would be a resentful person because of the way things fell out. So, you know, it's always fun to figure out what kind of characters I want to create to serve as foils for Austens, or to challenge Austens or compliment Austens, and how to, you know, have them fit into the story in between what is going on with Austen's characters and plot threads that I picked up from her.
Probably my favorite character in the story is Lady Denham's poor relation, Clara. And she comes from an area called Cheapside.
Yes, which actually is not as disreputable as it might sound. It's an area of London that...
But it sounds a little on the nose.
It does. It does. It sounds like kind of sketchy part of town. But actually, it's an area where a lot of merchants lived. And so for people who made their fortune, or, you know, made their livelihood at least, if not a huge fortune, in trade, it was a perfectly respectable address. But it was, you know, a world away from Mayfair and the areas that, you know, Mr. Darcy would be hanging out in, or Lady Denham.
People who earn their money?
Yes, exactly. We can't have any of that.
Now, the heart of the story picks up where the manuscript essentially leaves off, I think. They get to the house. Lady Denham is late for dinner, and then that's where the story really gets rolling.
And I kind of got that idea from Austen. We do see Lady Denham in the original manuscript, but Austen's manuscript itself breaks off when Charlotte first visits Sanditon House. They're in the drawing room, she and Mrs. Parker, and they're waiting for Lady Denham to arrive. And before she does, that's all she wrote. And so Lady Denham never arrives, you know, in that chapter of the book. And I thought, well, you know, what if all of these people, and Austen sets up, you know, these different groups of people that are all very interested in her will, you know, what if she had invited all of them to come visit her and never arrived? And then when other guests start disappearing, then the next question is, okay, is that related to what's going on with Lady Denham, or is that something else entirely? And that's part where some of the more gothic elements came into play, because conveniently this is also the anniversary of a disappearance of another young woman many years earlier.
Ivy Woodcock.
Yes, Ivy Woodcock, daughter of Mad Woodcock, the local hermit So being able to bring in, you know, those sort of ghost stories and legends and you know, campfire tales that people like to tell adds to the tension on, you know, on this dark and stormy night.
So you have kind of like the typical elements of a large spooky house suspense type thing going on, but then you throw in generous helpings of farce as things go along.
Yes, because, you know, as you said, Austen is known for her wit. And the manuscript of Sanditon, you know, what there is of it was so comic with these characters that I could tell she was having fun with them. It would be interesting to see how the completed Sanditon would have looked after she had a chance to revise. I mean, you wonder if all of her manuscripts started out, you know, a little more over the top, and if she scaled them back in successive drafts, or if this, you know, was a return to that younger self toward the end there. But yeah, I think if it's going to be based on Austen, it has to have humor. And humor is something that I, as a reader, look for and as a writer, enjoy. It's hard to write humor. I often, when I'm writing a scene, I'll sense that there's potential there. You know, there's something funny here that I can draw out. But finessing that takes multiple drafts and going back and you know, tugging on those threads until they come together.
And so much of it seems to be based in the ridiculousness of our self-regard.
Yes, absolutely. You know, would some power the gifty give us to see ourselves as others see us? And yeah, the self-importance of people and kind of deflating that. And Austen does that in all of her novels.
You mentioned the hermit, and he had a residence on the property, a hermitage. And I'd always just thought of the hermitages of Peter the Great and Andrew Jackson.
Yes.
I never thought that they actually had a show pony hermit on their property.
Yes, that's another weird thing, you know, that I, you know, in addition to the chamber horse, was the fact that in the 18th century, they were into, you know, the picturesque. These landowners, they would build all sorts of different, what they called follies, different, you know, structures on the grounds, like a summer house or a gazebo, or some had like little Grecian temples or whatever. And one of the things they would build was a hermitage, and then they would hire a hermit to live in it and just kind of be eccentric. The wealthy people would invite their friends over and they'd have a picnic and hope for a hermit sighting. You know, just like, you know, if we go to a national park and get excited because, you know, a bear strolls by or something. So I had a little fun with that character too, because Ebenezer Woodcock, he was a widower with a daughter, and so he wasn't the best hermit because he had this kid in tow for much of it. But the owner at the time tolerated that.
On a side note, there's a British comedy called Harry and Paul, and they have a recurring, it's a sketch comedy show, and they have a recurring sketch that's based on rich people in the South have pets, and these pets are actually people from the North.
Oh, that's great.
And so there's I can't remember he's supposed to be Scouse or Brummy, but he is always wearing his pajamas, and he has very tousled wild hair, and his name is Clive, and they treat him as if he were a dog. And he has a very thick northern accent, so they can't understand him very well. It's very all condescending. But it's meant to show the ridiculous behavior of the southerners toward the northerners in England. And it kind of made me think of that
along with the
hermitage.
Yeah, you have your pet hermit out there and hope for a sighting.
With this being the last of available text from Austen, what future is there for Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy in your writing?
Well, first of all, her completed novels have so much capacity for more stories. You know, there are characters from those novels that I haven't used yet at all. You know, I have readers write in sometimes and say, you know, oh, you know, I really liked The Matters at Mansfield, but you didn't use Fanny Price at all. And, you know, I only use the characters that are significant to the story that I am telling at the time, because I can't just trot in, you know, familiar characters just, you know, for a cameo and then trot them back out. I feel that they have to earn their words on the page. So there's room there. There's no limit of the, you know, plots I think you could come up with for Mr. Wickham and other, you know, troublemakers to come back again. Austen also left a novella, Lady Susan, which I haven't mined yet. She left another unfinished novel called The Watsons. And then she left three volumes of Juvenilia, stories, even a few poems and other writings that she did as a teenager and young woman. So there's more potential out there.
So you could have Elizabeth as like a Nancy Drew character.
We could. So there's room, you know, for more Mr. and Mrs. Darcy mysteries, as long as readers are interested in them. For myself, you know, I also want to pursue other types of writing. From the time that I first had a glimmer of an idea for this series to today, it's been 15 years since I first started it. And so, I do feel that I also have other stories that I want to tell. And a lot of authors, you know, alternate between series or standalone books and a series. And so, you know, whatever I write will be historical fiction. But for me, I have Elizabeth and Darcy to work with, and I have other ideas as well.
Well, you said you like to read widely. Do you know what kind of genre field, other than just a straight historical story, would you like to do something else?
Well, my first two novels, as I said, were fantasy novels. You know, fantasy still remains close to my heart. There's a romantic subplot in every one of my Darcy mysteries because, you know, that's a genre I also like. A historical fiction, you know, in general, you know, has so much potential because you can tell the same story in a different setting and it's a completely different story, you know, or you can take one setting and tell so many different stories within it. So I think those are probably the main other genre. I don't see myself writing a, you know, a Western or, I could not write a Stephen King type horror story to save my life. But everything else, you know, I'm open. And I think that that's where a lot of original ideas come from, is borrowing things from different genre traditions and combining those.
When you were talking earlier about having difficulties with battle scenes, I said, just watch an old Errol Flynn movie and choreograph from there.
Exactly. But that became a valuable experience, though, when I wrote The Deception at Lyme, because there was a lot of stuff in there about the Royal Navy. There were two mystery plots going on in there. One of them involved a cousin of Mr. Darcy's who had been a ship's lieutenant who allegedly died in battle. Darcy had reason to believe that perhaps he did not die in battle, but was helped toward that death. So I ended up having to get more into those battle scenes, you know, when they were discussing those. And that research led me to write a short story based on Jane Austen's brother, Frank, who was a ship's captain. And I found all sorts of very interesting information about the battle and events that led to his promotion to post-captain. And it was an interesting enough story that I decided to dramatize it. And so I had to pull out all of those battle scene writing, you know, experiences and get reacquainted with, you know, that side of my writer self. And I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. So there's room there for that, too.
I'm a bad radio book interviewer. I've never read any Jane Austen. I've seen several of the film adaptations.
Oh, well, all right.
But my memory had faded that Mr. Darcy's first name was Fitzwilliam, and it made utter sense why everyone calls him Mr. Darcy, because who wants to call anybody Fitzwilliam?
Yes, I I had trouble with that too. I had trouble, you know, when I first started the series, I was like, what would Elizabeth call him? Fitzwilliam, I it just seemed like such a mouthful that I couldn't picture her using that. But I also couldn't picture her using the formality of her mother, who always called her father Mr. Bennet, which was also a very common thing back then. Men among each other would call each other by their last names. They were close friends. And so I settled on Elizabeth calling Darcy, Darcy. Now, whether that was entirely period accurate is, you know, a matter of question. You know, I've had some readers say, you know, oh, I don't buy that. I've had other readers think it was, you know, as natural as I did. But that was what was comfortable for me as a writer, and in getting to know Darcy these many years, I think he's okay with my informality in addressing him that way.
Back to your upcoming work, I mean, have you started on something to move forward on?
I have. It's in such an embryonic state that I really can't talk about it. Books are very much like pregnancy, and, you know, sometimes you think something is viable, but it takes a while before you find out if it really is, and before you're comfortable talking about it. And also, you can't talk about a work too much early on or it eliminates the need to write it. So I'm still getting to know the characters that are occurring to me. And for me, that's where story comes from. You know, a lot of writers, you know, can sometimes be divided into two camps, you know, whether their stories are plot-driven or character-driven. And for me, the stories always evolve out of character. So I need to get to know these people a little better.
Yeah, because The Suspicion of Sanditon is not a sweeping novel. It's a very compressed time frame. It's essentially a day, pretty much. Most things take place.
Yes, yes, very much so. Yeah, almost all of the events of the novel take place in that single night, which was also a challenge for me because I'd never written a book that the story was that compressed. I mean, you know, some of the Darcy mysteries, things take place within a couple of weeks, but others, you know, it's over the span of months. So to work within that tight time frame was fun. And, you know, as a writer, you know, seven books into a series, you're looking for, you know, how can this be fresh for me too? And how can I make it, you know, fresh for the readers too? In addition to, you know, still being, you know, comforting and familiar, because that's why you come back to a series, because you like the characters and you want more of them.
Things are fresh for Book Talk listeners.
Yes.
Because this is your first appearance, and I want to thank you so much for stopping by.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Carrie Bebris is the author of The Suspicion at Sanditon, the seventh novel in the Mr. and Mrs. Darcy series, which is published by Tor. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.